Angela says, are you interested? She said, I have a bunch of documents from Greg Scarpa Jr. and FBI 302 memos to confirm them. And I said, am I interested? So I was in Santa Barbara at the time. I went to New York and met with her, and eventually I got this, it's about 2.5 inches thick pile of documents, and I was able to authenticate them. And basically what they show, Ian, is about a 9-month period from about March of 1996 all the way to actually an 11-month period up until February of 97, that Scarpa Jr., and nobody could make this up in a million years, he was in Ramzi Youssef, the original Trade Center bomber, and the man I say is the architect of 9/11, is in cell, let's say cell number one. In between him is, in the next cell, is Greg Scarpa Jr., who's awaiting RICO mafia charges, you know, a trial on RICO violations.
Right.
And on the other side is Abdul Hakim Murad, who was Youssef's, one of his oldest friends, grew up in Kuwait with him, was a pilot trained in 4 U.S. flight schools, and they had been a member of a cell in Manila after the original Trade Center bombing. Youssef fled, eventually went to Manila, and had a cell there with 4 members. One was Murad, one was Youssef's uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is now identified as the mastermind of 9/11 by the FBI, and the 4th conspirator was named Wali Khan Amin Shah. They had a fire in their bomb factory in early January of 95, and Youssef fled with KSM to Islamabad. Youssef was captured a month later. KSM escaped. Murad was captured that night. Wali Khan was captured a few days later. He escaped, and they finally got the 3 of them. They got Youssef, Wali Khan, and Murad back to New York, and they were going to try them first for what they call the Bojinka plot. And Bojinka was a Serbo-Croatian word for big noise that Youssef had coined the phrase for this plot. Now, this plot was completely separate from the planes as missiles plot, the suicide plot that became 9/11. This is a completely distinct plot in which the conspirators would get on the board the first leg of a 2-leg U.S.-bound flight full of U.S. tourists from Asia. And let's say they would get on a United flight in Hong Kong that was bound for Singapore and then on to San Francisco. And one of them would then get on the flight and smuggle on board the first leg the components of what I call a bomb trigger that is made up of a Casio watch, a circuit powered by 9-volt batteries, a diluted nitroglycerin with cotton balls, which becomes what's called nitrocellulose or gun cotton, a high explosive, and that it would be the point of ignition would be what they call a broken bulb initiator, a small little bulb from a pen light flash.
Right.
They'd build this device and they'd put it in the life jacket pouch under a seat above, and this is important now for TWA-800 later on, above the center wing fuel tank of the plane, so that this little device would act as a kind of blasting cap that would blow down into through the passenger cabin floor into the tank, explode the vapors and turn the plane into a flying bomb, essentially, okay?
Right.
So Youssef, again, and you have to understand the criminal genius of Ramzi Youssef. I mean, it's a tragedy that he wasn't on our side. He was educated in Wales. He's an engineer. And he went from building weapons of mass destruction, like the original World Trade Center device, which is a 1,500-pound urea nitrate fuel oil bomb, that he moved to a location by truck, in the case of the original bombing, a Ryder truck parked on the B2 level below the north tower of the Trade Center with the intent of knocking Tower 1 into Tower 2. He went from that kind of technology, thinking outside the box, to creating this kind of little, what they literally called, and they bragged about, their undetectable bomb. So he did what he called a wet test on a Philippine Airlines 747 on the night of December 11th, 1994, while they were in Manila, and he got on board in the morning of early morning flight from Manila to Cebu in the southern Philippines, and the flight was then going to go on to Narita in Japan. And posing as an Italian national, wearing religious medals around his neck so that if he got wanded at the checkpoint, he would, you know, if he set off the metal detectors, they'd go, oh, he's a Catholic, you know.
Right.
Well, he had this Casio watch, and he had a little female kind of connector coming out that he had tucked under the watch, and that was tied to what we call the C106D capacitor, which he soldered into the watch. And that was later the feds at trial called that Yousef's signature. You know how every, you know, bomb, diabolical bomb maker has a certain tell or a signature or, you know, a device that they're able to use to connect them to the device. This was Yousef's signature, this little capacitor. And so he has the watch, and he's got a little shaving kit, and he gets on board, and as the flight goes to Cebu, only like 50 people aboard in the early morning, he goes to a backward row, because he figured if he went inside the lav, he might get, you know, they might knock on the door, what are you doing in there? And he put together this device. He had a 9-volt battery in the heel of each shoe, and he took them out, popped them into the circuit, connected the circuit to the little female connector, broke the bulb, wired that in, so he had like a little filament kind of pig's tail at the end of the line, shoved cotton balls into the diluted nitro, which is in a contact lens cleaning bottle, and taped it all carefully together and set the watch X number of hours ahead, put the entire device inside the shaving kit, and then he moved up, and this is crucial, he moved to the 26th row, and he put the device in the life jacket pouch under seat 26K. He got off the plane and flew immediately, paid cash for a ticket, went back to Manila, snuck up the stairs of the Donna Josepha apartments and emerged at about 1 o'clock yawning so that the guard who recorded the in and out of everyone in the building would see, oh, you know, he's just coming out now. So he had an alibi. And the plane on its way to Japan at Point Mike Delta, unfortunately, a young Japanese national named Haruki Ikegami, 24 years old, was sitting in seat 26K. And the bomb went off and blew down into the fuselage from the passenger cabin. And by an act of God, Yousef had placed the bomb a couple of rows too far back. The fuel tank actually began around the 24th to the 25th row. But in any case, killed this poor young man, cut him in half, and blew it down into the plane. And the heroic pilot was able to land the plane in Okinawa. Now Yousef, Khalid Sheikh, Wally Khan and Murad toasted that night in a karaoke bar in Manila, knowing that all they had to do in the future was push these devices forward, and they would have flying bombs. And they intended, in the Bojinka plot, to plant up to 12 of these, three each, over a 48-hour period. Now imagine what that would have done to worldwide air travel if only one or two of these had ever gone off. And they were interdicted in their plot by the fire in the bomb factory.